Good evening. I see there's more from us. Good evening. I'm going to start talking. Feel free to pass around the question while I speak. I'm Aviva Edelstein, and I am one of the co-chairs of the Wealth Education Committee at Community Insurance. We're so happy that you're all here tonight, looking around this really incredible crowd, which we're so happy and grateful to see, and really just such a reflection of our remarkable speaker tonight, who I will soon say a few words about. This free feedback event is co-sponsored by Karen and David Federbush and by Debbie Sondheim for Refuah Shalema, for Rizal Shoshana, Fak Aviva Hana. We, the Adult Education Committee of B'nai Asherim, are constantly thinking ahead as how to meaningfully mark the milestone events on the Jewish calendar. We seek out speakers and topics that will engage us intellectually and spiritually. We appreciate opportunities to reflect on classical Jewish texts and wisdom, and to consider learning them again for the first time. It takes a special kind of educator to open our minds and hearts to invite new perspectives on what we thought we knew. The hope is that as we contemplate the literature and ideas with which we may already be familiar, whether from Chumash, the Siddur, or even the Haggadah, that we will allow ourselves to attain greater depth and connection and be truly transformed by their teaching. In preparation for Pesach, one of the most complex and transformative holidays of the year, we felt excited to reach out to the one and only Rabbi David Foreman. With his unique gift of bringing Torah study to life through poetic language, role-playing, technology, or even destination retreat, Rabbi Foreman has enlightened Jewish minds and souls across the world. We feel very honored to have him with us. Rabbi Foreman is an internationally renowned lecturer on biblical themes and the founder and principal educator at Aleph Beta. He has served as an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University and as a lead writer and editor for Art Scrolls Talmud Translation Project. Rabbi Foreman has also served as scholar for the Hofberger Foundation for Torah Study. His most recent publication is Genesis, a Parsha Companion, the first of a five-volume set on the weekly Torah portion. Tonight's topic is the unfinished melody of the Song of the Sea. Please join me in warmly welcoming Rabbi David.
Join the meeting.
Hey, hi everybody. It's really nice to see you. Thank you for coming out in the wet and cold to share some time learning together. Really fantastic to see you all, and I'm looking forward to getting a chance to learn with you here. The ideas I'm talking to you about today are part of something larger, but I guess everything is part of something larger. And I'll try to take a piece of this and see what it is that we can unearth together. Ultimately, I want to talk to you about the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, but I want to do so from a couple of different perspectives that we don't normally think of as part of the Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. And I'll begin with two introductions. The first introduction is that we all know that the Torah contains primarily two different genres of literature, for lack of a better word, stories and laws. And it might seem strange that our book has stories in it and has laws in it. You know, if you think of the Torah as a law book, so what are all the stories doing in it? And if you think of the Torah as a storybook, a history book, what are all the laws doing in it? And it seems to me that, you know, one way to answer the story is that the book is neither a storybook nor a law book, but something else. It's a guidebook, as the name Torah would suggest. Torah from the language of Lahorot, to guide. And what it takes to guide humans, perhaps, is a mix of stories and laws. Laws is too narrow a discipline to completely guide us. It can offer some guidance in life following halacha, but merely following laws is not the be-all and end-all of what it means to be a good person. And there's something that stories contribute to that picture, too. And that's a good enough answer as far as it goes, that a guidebook would have to include stories and have to include laws to really guide you. But it's still somewhat dissatisfying in a way, because it looks like a book, which really should be one book, is dichotomized, has these two different parts to it that never the twain shall meet. It's just that it's got a little bit of this, a little bit of that, sort of different strokes for different folks at different times of life. But what I want to show you tonight is that if you look just underneath the hood, often you'll find a very fascinating confluence between stories and laws. You'll actually find it's something quite remarkable. Every once in a while, you come across somebody who will try to figure out a rationale for a law in the Torah. What we sometimes call Tanya mitzvahs, trying to understand what the mitzvahs are all about, where these laws come from, and what they're about. Speaking personally, I've never been terribly enamored with that quest. Because, you know, you put nine relatively creative people in a room, give them any law in the Torah, and they'll give you nine relatively creative interpretations of the meaning of that law. And at the end of the day, for each one of them, you can shake their hand and say, Yashikah, it's really very wonderful. Thank you very much. At the end of the evening, hearing those nine expositions, you go home confused, not really convinced of the veracity of any one of them. Because, like in mathematics, when you have a point, how many lines can you draw through that point? Then you can draw an infinite number of lines through a point. If you have a particular law, how many interpretations can I give you for that law? If I'm creative enough, I can give you an infinite number of interpretations for that law. But where do I have the confidence in any one of them that there's something really real here? But every once in a while, you'll notice that the Torah itself gives you a clue as to what the larger significance of a law might be. And it does so sort of through a process which I'll just call one dot, two dots, which is like, look, if you have one dot, mathematically, you can draw an infinite number of lines through that one dot. But what if I have two dots? How many lines can I draw through two dots? I can only draw one line.
Well, what if the Torah, oh, there goes my microphone. What if the Torah, there looks like it's back again. What if the Torah gave me two dots for a particular law? What would those two dots look like? Well, what would happen if you were reading a law and then you noticed that there was this language that echoed from this story in the Torah? And then there was, you come across further language of the law that also echoes in the same story. And this happens, you know, once or twice, you think it's a coincidence. But once it happens five, six, seven, or eight times, it doesn't feel like a coincidence anymore. It feels like the Torah is telling you that there's something about this law that has to do with this story. And then the challenge is on you, right? What the Torah seems to be saying is that this law responds to the issues in this story, which in a way makes sense because it's starting to bring together these two disciplines of the Torah, stories and law. They're not really two things, they're one thing. We're a people, right? When God decides what laws to give us as a people, he looks at our history. He says, look, what are your triumphs? What are your pitfalls? What are your challenges? What's your story been like? Well, I'll play off of your story and build laws that respond to the issues that you've been struggling with or been successful with or want to build on in your story. And these become your laws. I want to take an example of a law tonight and try to show you how that might be so in a way that impacts, I think, our understanding of existence, right? So that's introduction number one. Here's introduction number two. Introduction number two gets to what I think is an antecedent for the law and the story that I really want to talk about tonight. It's another story earlier on in the Torah. It doesn't at face value seem to have much to do with Yetzias Mitzrayim. But when you start thinking about it, I think it just might. I'll reveal the mystery story at the heart of my second introduction for a moment, but to begin to see why it might be relevant as an antecedent to the story of the Exodus, consider this episode at the very beginning of the Exodus. Moshe's at the burning bush, and God tells him the following. God says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to the elders of Israel, and I'm reading now from chapter 3 in Exodus. You can follow along with me or just listen. God says, I want you to tell the elders of Israel, Hakot Pakadat Yetta, I have come to redeem you, Bet Hasu Lachem Mitzrayim, and what was done to you in Egypt. I'm right now about to read verse 17, Pasuk Yud Zayin of chapter 3. And the challenge I want to give you as you listen to the language at the burning book is, what earlier story in the Torah does any of this remind you? Hakod Pakadatiyat, I have come to redeem you and what was done to you in Egypt. Ba'omar, and I say, Allah etem, I will take you out on the Yitzrayim from the suffering of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites. El Eretz Zavat Kolav Upash, to the land flowing with milk and honey, verse 18. And these elders are going to listen to you, and you and they, you're going to go to the king of Egypt, and you can say to them the following. Eloheim Ivrim Mikra'ilim, the God of the Hebrews, just happened to come to us. Ata Nelchana, let us go, let us walk, please. Derach Shloshet Yamim, for 3 days' journey from Midbar in the desert. The Nizbacha Hashem Elokeinu. But we'd like to offer offerings to our God. That's what you should tell the king of Egypt. And I know it's not going to work. And when that happens, I'm going to stretch out my hand to Ikatia Mitzrayim. I will strike Egypt with all of my might, with all of my wonders, miracles, Asher Aseh B'Kirbo, that I will do amongst them. And after that, they'll send you out.
So that's what God says to Moshe at the burning bush. And by the way, this is a strange story. I don't know if you've ever sort of asked yourself any questions about it, but if you notice, the story I just read to you generally doesn't make it into any of the Hollywood theatrical productions of the Exodus. When you were watching The Prince of Egypt, when you were watching Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments, do you ever remember the part where he says, "Let my people go for 3 days and we'll come right back"? Never says that, right? It's always, "Let my people go," right? The part about the 3 days and come back, don't left on the cutting room floor. But that's what it actually says. "Let my people go for 3 days and we'll come right back." Which makes you think, like, come on, like, you're God. What do you need to lie for? What do you need to be circumspect for? What's with this ambiguity of whether we're coming back after 3 days? Just say, like, you're God, you have all, you do whatever you want. Just say, we're leaving, right? But that's the way it is. We're going to go, we're going to come back, and it's going to be for 3 days. We're just going to go to worship. So my question is, what story, if any, earlier in the Torah, does this remind you of? Yeah. Yes, is that lady a free cover? It's the story of Akedat Yitzchak. It's the story of the binding of Isaac. Think about it. A 3-day journey. A journey, that's the, right? Abram goes for 3 days, Vayarat HaMachom Merachot, right? He goes for 3 days and he sees the place. What place? The place that he's going to go. Sacrifice to his God. And remember how God says over here in the Exodus, I'm going to go and bring you up. Well, what did he tell Abraham? Bring him up as an Ola. Go and on this 3-day journey, right? And then you're going to go. Remember how Abraham sort of gets lied to by God? I mean, right? Because Abraham, because God is like, well, I'll take him to the top of the mountain and then, like, just kidding, right? You'll come right down. But Abraham doesn't really know that and tells his lads at the bottom of the mountain, we're going to go worship our God, and then we're going to come right back. But that's not really true, or we're not really sure if that's true. It feels like a similar setup. So much so that, and what about this? Hakod Hakadati, that language, what does that remind you of in the Abram story with Yitzhak? Anybody? Hakod Hakadati? That the very birth of Isaac itself. Hashem Pakad et Sarah. A strange language. When's the last time you heard that kind of language with reference to a woman conceiving? But somehow this notion that Sarah conceives with that language of Pakad, the same language that God is going to use here to redeem the people. And what about this? God says, and when it doesn't work at the end, but Shalakti et Yadi, the Atheist and Sarayim. Shalakti et Yadi, anybody? Does that remind you of anything in the come on, guys, right? The angel comes out of the clouds and says, Al Tishlach Yadkal Anar, right? And then here comes God with the Shalat Yad Yadi. So it seems like there's some mysterious resonance here, just in these few psukim that we've read, of the Akedah in some kind of way, as if the Akedah is some sort of antecedent story to what it is that we're reading now. Weird. Mysterious, what do we make of them? That's introduction number two. Introduction number one, stories become our laws. Stories might just be the antecedents for laws. Story number two, what in the world does the Akedah have to do with Yetziat Mitzrayim? We have time later today to remind me at the end, if you want to stick around. I'll share with you something truly entertaining. Really shouldn't tell you this, but the parallels to the Akedah and the parallels between the Akedah and the story of Yitzhak and Sarayim are many, multiple, manifold, and profound. I've given you just a few on just a few psukim in the burning bush. There are many more. I don't want to get into them in great detail tonight, because if I do, I'll end up spending the whole night just talking to you about that. And that's not the only thing I want to talk to you about, but I'll give you a homework. If you want to look at this at home, Shabbos table conversation with your kids. God promises at the burning bush
a kind of redemption that seems Al-Qaeda-like. The question is, well, when it actually happens, is the redemption Al-Qaeda-like? Well, the great moment of final redemption is the splitting of the sea. If you read the story of the splitting of the sea, you'll find that it matches up almost point for point with the Al-Qaeda, right? The, won't get into any detail, but remember the people when they see the Mitzrayim coming. Right? They see the Egyptians coming from afar. What does that remind you of? Right? When Abraham sees the place of doom from afar, and they're very scared. And then there's this conversation, and the people say, they start to realize that maybe they'll get sacrificed. Maybe they're going to die. Like, you know, in the beginning, it was just, we're going to go sacrifice our God. We never realized that when we go, we're going to be the ones who sacrifice. What does this remind you of in the Al-Qaeda? What sort of conversation happens where realization
pretty good NHL debut.
Sacrifice might be you. That's the conversation that Yitzhak had with Avram. And then an angel comes out of the clouds and says, don't touch. Remember that in the Al-Qaeda? Well, what happens next in the story of the splitting of the sea? An angel comes out of the cloud, and the angel goes and positions itself, if you remember, between seems like, as you read through the story, the angel is somehow playing out. The question is, why did it mean? Great mystery. So who did I ask about this? Who are you going to go to ask about this? Which Rebbe are you going to go to talk to this about? Nobody talks about this. You can't find it in the Sfarim. So who did I talk to? ChatGPT. I'm not kidding. On my way over, I figured, what the heck? I'm going to talk about this in Connect. Let's see what ChatGPT has to say for itself. I asked ChatGPT to contrast and compare the story of the Al-Qaeda to the story of the binding of Isaac, and you would not believe what kind of conversation I had with Isaac. I'll save that for the epilogue of this talk. So we'll talk about that if you want to stick around. But it was really pretty mind-blowing. I've been thinking a lot about this whole artificial intelligence thing. And it, I don't know, it's very spooky to me. If you really want to get spooked out, stick around and I'll share with you some highlights from that conversation. But let's begin to talk a little bit about the Al-Qaeda itself, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it now, and then save the rest of my remarks on this for the end, when I kind of tie things together as to how the Al-Qaeda might relate to the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. But let me begin by suggesting to you that the Al-Qaeda, of course, is one of the most difficult stories in the entire Torah, right? It's a tough story to read, not a great bedtime story for your five-year-old. Little kid Billy, right, who's wondering his parents might, you know, what they might do to him one day at the top of the hill that they go hiking to. Tough story to read, tough story to understand. And it strikes me that there's two basic questions that a reader of the Al-Qaeda needs to grapple with as they read the story. The first is, the question that moral philosophers over the ages have grappled with in the story, which is, from a moral perspective, what in the world is going on? If God comes out of the clouds and says, go kill your kid at the top of the mountain, how are you supposed to deal with that? Like, from a moral perspective, does it make it right? Like, for God to do that? Like, did God do that? And is that the right thing to do? In other words, maybe Abraham should have just said no, but Abraham didn't say no. Abraham said yes, and we revere saying yes, which is tough from a moral standpoint because, you know, we invoke Abraham's zechus, so to speak, on Yom HaNorayim, and it's all very nice because in the end he didn't have to do it, but if we herald him for his heroism in the story, you have to figure that we would have to herald him even if the angel didn't come at the last moment and stay his hand, and he had gone through with it, which would have made for a very different story indeed, and a much more difficult story. How are you supposed to herald Abraham as a hero. So the first question is, how do we understand the morality of the Akedah? And a lot of ink has been spilled on this. The Rub was fond of quoting Soren Kierkegaard, Fear and Trembling. This is one approach to this question. Going all the way back in Western philosophy, you've got Plato and the Euthyphro dialogue, who basically tries to squarely confront this issue of God's relationship to morality, dealing with these mind-bending questions of, are things moral because God said they're moral, or does God say things that happen to be moral irrespective of God's will? It's a mind-bending dilemma. It's what Plato talked about. There's all sorts of ways you think about this, but let's just say that question number one that you have to sort of grapple with in the Akedah is how do you understand the morality of it? That's question number one, but it's not the only question. Question number two is, however you understand the morality of the Akedah, it's one thing to say God is morally justified or is morally permissible for God to ask this of Abraham. It's another thing to try to figure out why in the world God would do it in the first place. In other words, just because it's morally permissible to ask of something doesn't mean you should ask it. It might be morally permissible if you as a parent, according to the Rambam's Yadav Chazaka, to ask your child to stand up every time you come in the room. It is, in fact, morally permissible for you to do that. It doesn't mean you should. You know what I mean? Just because God can get away with asking Abraham to do this, why would he do such a thing? Why would he tell Abraham to go to the top of the mountain, kill his kid, and say, just kidding, forcing Abraham into this grotesque position of almost mimicking this abusive father who, with a knife over his kid, who's getting ready to kill his father, only to have God say, like, don't do it at the last moment, when really that would be the last thing that Abraham will normally ever think of doing. Like, why such a weird test? What exactly would that, how exactly would that make sense? So this last question, I want to leave for the end of our discussion this evening, but I want to attack that first question now, the morality of the Akedah. And what I want to suggest to you is a very basic, simple way, I think, of understanding the morality of the Akedah, which might set up for us an answer to the second question of why God would do this. Here's a simple way of thinking about the morality of the Akedah. In my mind, all fair disclosure, it's really the only way I can think of making the Akedah work from a moral perspective. And it sort of circumvents all of Plato's arguments and everything else. It seems to me that, and I think the language of the Akedah suggests this, and I don't want to get into it too deeply, but let me put it to you this way. What if we thought of the Akedah as a custody battle? If you thought about it as a custody battle, things might begin to make sense. And let me explain to you how it could be a custody battle. Here's what I want you to imagine. Imagine that a couple was going through a divorce, and the question was, what's going to be with the kids? Who's going to have custody of the kids, mom or dad? And imagine that the court is going to decide this question, who's going to have custody, on the basis of a single criterion only, a little bit different than courts nowadays. They aren't going to ask fuzzy-wuzzy questions like, what's in the best interest of the child? Where is the child going to like living more? They're going to settle this in din. They're going to settle this in justice. And the question that they're going to ask is, who is the primary parent, right? Who has the claim as the most primary parent such that they can have claim over this child, okay? So let's imagine that that's the criterion of the court. You're the lawyer for the father, right? Lawyer for the father gets up, makes his case before the court. What does he say? This child is my legacy. This child is going to carry on my father's name. My grandpappy had the name, the name Hendricks, and my father had the name Hendricks. I bear that name, and this child is the only surviving Hendricks, and he's going to carry on my legacy forward into the next generation. All right? That's what the father has to say. You're the lawyer for the mother. You're the lawyer for the mother. What would you say to try to establish your client as primary care. What would you say? Carried him for 9 months in my womb. Gave birth to this child. Nursed this child. Raised this child. Nurtured this child throughout their life, even before life, right? That's a pretty strong argument to be considered the primary parent. You know, father, momentary contribution. Mother, you know, carried this child, brought this child into being. That's a pretty strong argument, which probably has something to do with the reason why mothers generally will prevail in cases like this. In a certain kind of way, they can be seen as primary parent. But now imagine that just before the case is concluded, and just before the judge hands down the rule, another lawyer scampers into the room and asks for a moment to make his case. The judge says, sure, who are you representing? Says, I'm representing a third party. Really? Who are you representing? I'm representing God, the master of the universe. He would like to be considered as primary parent. Generally, my client does not make this request to be considered primary parent, but here, in fact, he would like to. If you were the lawyer for God, what argument would you advance in your 30 seconds in that courtroom? What would you say? What would you say? What's that?
Without me, this kid wouldn't be alive.
Elaborate, please. Then when some lawyer for the mother is very offended, oh, are you kidding, Your Honor? I carried this child in my womb for 9 months. I nursed this child. You're the lawyer for God. How would you retort?
The human.
That's right. Do you know the biochemistry of your womb? Could you recreate one enzyme that's responsible for making this thing work, right? That all the trillions of dollars in medical research, we've not yet even succeeded in copying a womb and making an artificial womb when you have the template. All you need is a 3D printer, and still you can't even do that. Right? You for sure can't innovate the thing. That's me, right? All you are is a vessel for my procedure called the great divine mystery of human reproduction. That's a pretty compelling case, right? If you were the judge, you might just award that child to God. What if you viewed the Akeda as that sort of custody battle? In other words, for some reason, God was interested at the very birth of this nation in establishing a truth about the nation, which is, who exactly is its primary parent, right? Was it a coincidence that this child was born at the end of Abraham and Sarah's life when biologically that usually doesn't happen? Think back to that language we described before, that pakod pakadati language in the Akeda, such strange language, Hashem pakad et Sarah. Can you translate those words? If you know biblical Hebrew a little bit, you know that pakad is one of those strange words. Very hard to really know exactly what it means because it has a number of different shades of meaning. But how might you translate the word pakad? Hashem pakad et Sarah. And trust. Hakad from the language of pikadon, right? Something which I give to you in trust, something that you're holding, but you don't quite own, right? You're a shomer over, you're a watchman over. I will eventually redeem that which I've entrusted to you. Much as God says in the Exodus, hakod hakadati. In other words, might the first moment of redemption, when God would redeem what's his, not be the Exodus, but the Akedah, when God basically says, I'm here to take back what's mine. I don't usually get involved in these custody battles, but if I would get involved, I could in a world of judgment, assert my rights, right? Can you recognize my rights? And interestingly, listen to the language of the angel at the end of the Akedah. When the angel says that you are a Yareh Elohim, you are a fearer of God, lo chasachta et bincha yechidcha mimadik. Listen to those words. And you didn't withhold your son, your only son, from me. But that language, withhold, suggests that who is the rightful parent? I am the rightful parent. I, God, am the one, right? It's almost like you'd imagine a custody battle. Imagine, you know, the mother winning in the custody battle. And father has him for a weekend, right? And then joins the mother and gives him back to mom, right? And mom says, I appreciate you being on time. I appreciate you being courteous. I appreciate lo chasachta es bincha yechidcha mimani. I know how much you love this child, but you didn't withhold him from his rightful parent. You were willing to give him back to me. At the end of this, it's almost like the language of what God is using here. What if that were the moral rationale for the Akedah? If it were, it might just help us understand why the Akedah, why God would have engineered the Akedah in the first place. In some mysterious way, I want to argue tonight, it sets up Yitzhak Mitzrayim. It sets up the Exodus from Egypt. The Exodus from Egypt could not have happened in some way without this story. Hence, the copious parallels of the Akedah as if it's happening again. Now, how do we understand that? In what way does the Akedah really set up Yitzhak Mitzrayim? For that, we kind of need to dive into the body of this law. And that's what I want to do with you tonight, to start talking about this law and the story and how the law and the story fuse together. So let's begin with the law. The law I want to talk about tonight is the law of the Rotseach, the murderer, and the Goel Adam. The story of the law of somebody who kills inadvertently, and the laws of the family avenger, right? You know what happens in these laws. We get them a couple times in the Torah. And I'll go through the law in a moment to kind of reintroduce it for you. But basically, the law is that there's two kinds of murder. There's two kinds of people who kill. There's those who kill with malice aforethought, and those who kill inadvertently. If you kill with malice aforethought, that's a capital crime. But if you kill inadvertently, so, you know, different people see that differently. The Torah says, well, you know, you're basically innocent. But that's not the way a relative necessarily can see it. If I'm chopping wood in the forest and the axe blade slips and it hits somebody 30 feet away, so, you know, the brother of the person who died is going to look at me and is going to come after me. The Torah says that it is a mitzvah upon society to build cities of refuge, Arei Miklat, to allow an inadvertent murderer to escape to these Arei Miklat to avoid the vengeance of a Goel Adam, a family redeemer. And again, these laws are given at different places in the Torah. Let's begin in Dvarim. In Dvarim and Parshas Be'ezhanah, we have one example of these laws, and what happens there is that Israel has just conquered the eastern side of the Jordan River, and God commands Arei Miklat to be set up there. Moshe actually set up Arei Miklat, three Arei Miklat, on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And when he does, he uses language which is very interesting and very striking. It was brought to my attention on the way to the shul one morning when I was chatting with my son, Abifai, who pointed this out to me. He says, Abba, listen to the language of this week's parsha about Moshe setting aside his Arei Miklat. Az Yavdil Moshe, Shalosh Arim Be'ever HaYarden. That's when Moshe separated three cities on the other side of the Jordan River. Now, if I would just take those words, those three words, Az Yavdil Moshe, right? What other three words elsewhere in the Torah does Az Yavdil Moshe
Come on, guys. Asya shir Moshe, right? That's what it sounds like. It's almost like a perfect substitution. Take the verb, just take the verb out, take the rest of it, and instead of the verb badal, right, use the verb shara, right, to sing, and Asya vil Moshe becomes Asya shir Moshe. Now, what's interesting about Asya vil Moshe also is that the grammar in and of itself is strange. How would you even translate it? As, then, Yavdil would be the future tense. Then Moshe will separate? No, then Moshe separated. Why are you talking about something in the past as if it was in the future? It's a weird thing. Well, you can ask the same question about Az Yashir Moshe. That's when Moshe sang. What do you mean the future tense? It's in the past tense. It feels like the Torah is playing. It feels like when the Torah writes the words Az Yavdil Moshe, it wants you to have this reaction, which so many of you in this room had, that sure sounds like Az Yashir Moshe. So that was Avichai's question. Do you think Az Yavdil Moshe echoes Az Yashir Moshe, or is that a coincidence? So let me actually put that question to you right now. Right? If you were asked this question, if I decided to dismiss you half an hour early tonight, I said, okay, everybody home, it's raining outside, you all should go to sleep and get an early night, and this is the end of this talk tonight. And somebody asked you, so what do we want to talk about here? Because I don't know, he's got this crazy theory about stories and laws, and he thinks that there's something about this story with the Ari Mikla that has something to do with this, with the sort of about this, these laws of Ari Mikla have something to do with the story of Shirat Hayam. And he said, yeah, so what was the evidence he cited for it? He said, well, he's got this thing with Az Yavdil Moshe. Sure sounds like Az Yashir Moshe. Strange language, strange conjugation. Only other time we really have that language with Moshe, right? And then what if the person said to you, well, do you think that's true? In other words, do you buy the theory? Are you convinced that, are you convinced that this is true? Now, let me be very clear what I mean. I don't mean, are you willing to go over to Foreman after his talk and say, yeah, Shabbat, that was a very nice talk. I get that you might be willing to do that, right? But what I really mean is that in your heart of hearts, right, are you convinced that that's probably true? In other words, like, let's take the bet your house standard, right? Like, what if somebody came to you right now and said, I have a red phone, right, and we can call up to heaven right now, and we can talk to God, and we can ask him this one question. When you wrote the Torah, and you wrote the words, Az Yavdil Moshe, right, did you want people thinking, Az Yashir Moshe? Now, if you say, I'm willing to bet my house on that, right, then if God says, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. When I said Az Yavdil Moshe, I did phrase it that way, because I wanted people to be thinking, Az Yashir Moshe. Then you get double the money of your house right now. Easy way to double the money of your house. But if you make that bet, God at the other end of the line says, how creative, I never thought of that. Then you lose your house. You understand? Okay, now I want to know how many people are willing to bet their house, easy double or nothing money, right now. We're taking bets. Raise your hand if you're willing to bet your house and double your money. I do not see that many people. A lot of people are going to say nice year, Foreman, but not that many people who are willing to bet the house. Okay. So let me just challenge you for a moment. Could you imagine, though, walking out of with enough evidence to bet your house? Could you imagine that? You could imagine that. What would it take? What would you need to see in order to get enough evidence that there's something about Ari Mikla that the author of the text wants you to be thinking about the song of the sea and the associated struggle with Hillel? What would you have to see besides Az Yavdil Moshe in order to convince you of such a thing?
Well, three on this side, Abraham.
Okay, well, you're getting really particular. I'm just, like, just generally, what would you like? Just generally. Parallel. Show me more. Right? It's one thing, one parallel, very interesting. Two parallels, still interesting. Show me three. Show me 4. Show me 5. Show me 7. Right? The more the merrier. Right? So let's see. Let's actually go through the text and see. And so for that, what I want to do is take you now into the next iteration of our Mikvah, which appears in Devarim 19. If you haven't had the Pamesh, you can open up to Devarim 19. So let's read from the beginning of Devarim 19. And what I want you to do as we read this text, again, is think whether there's anything about this text that reminds you of anything that has to do with either Shiras HaYam or Israel's struggle with Pharaoh more generally. Okay? Shalosh Arim Tavila. Set aside 3 cities for yourself. The Tov Artsafai Jerusalem Lachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachachach you the road, the Shilash that Gular Tefa, and divide your borders into thirds. Asher Yan Kulcha Hashem Alokecha, that God will provide for you. Vayalanus Shabbat Horotzeach, and any murderer will be able to flee there. Zed Bar Horotzeach, Asher Yanus Shabbat. Now, when we say any murderer will be able to flee there, it depends. This is the kind of murderer that can flee there, v'chai, and live. Asher Yaka Efra Eobudlidat, somebody who killed, who strikes somebody without intent. Ulo Sanelo Mitzmol Shoshal, somebody who didn't hate his fellow yesterday and the day before. For example, Asher Yabo Esrayu Bayar, imagine that somebody came upon his fellow in the forest, locked him, ate him, and was chopping wood. The Nidatha Yado Bakarzan, and his hand slipped on the axe before the ate as he was chopping down the tree. The Nashal Habarzal Mina ate, and it happened that the blade flew off of the axe. Of the axe handle, Umata Esrayu, and found his friend 30 yards away from mate. Who Yanus Shama? It's that kind of murderer who can flee El Achat Harim Ha'ila into one of these cities of refuge, the Chai. Why do I want these cities of refuge? Because Pen Yir don't go Al Adam Acharei, because we're concerned that the Goel Adam, the family avenger, might run after the murderer, Ki Yecham Levavo, because his heart is very aflame, did he see go, and he would catch up to the murderer. Ki Yirba Aderach, because what if it's too long to get to one of these cities, and it's a long, long road, and there's plenty of time for the avenger to catch up to him, be Koh Nefesh, and ultimately he strikes him dead. Below Ein Mishpat Mavet, but he shouldn't have died. Because he didn't hate him yesterday and the day before. Let's read just up till there. Can you find any parallel at all between this story and the story of Pharaoh and the Jewish people of the sea? Very good. So, Debbie, if I'm not mistaken, but I see you from that far away, says, in verse 6, there's a very interesting parallel. Pen Yirdot Goel Hadam Acharei Rotzeach, Bihi Sigo. The language that describes the Goel Hadam, the family avenger running after the inadvertent murderer, is comprised of two verbs. Those verbs are Radaf and Lahasik. Pen Yirdot Goel Hadam Acharei Rotzeach, Bihi Sigo. Lest you run after the murderer and be sigo and catch up with them. What does that remind you of at the story of the splitting of the sea? Did anybody run after anybody else and catch up with them? Well, they sure did. Who ran after his? Pharaoh runs after the Jewish people escaping and catches up with him. Not only does Pharaoh run and catch up with him, but it's exactly the same two Hebrew verbs in conflict. And for that, just take a look back at the story of the splitting of the sea, where you have this language in Pasuk Bet. I don't have the chapter here. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down, but I think it's Yud-Dal. Right? So Yud-Dal at Pasuk Bet. Yitazek Hashem et Lev Paro. God stiffens the heart of Pharaoh and makes it very strong. Now let me try. Yirdo after Achan and Israel, verse 8, and he runs after the people of Israel. And then next verse, by years of food, Mitzrayim Achareyev, and Mitzrayim is running after them, by Yasiduot HaMakovim Alayam, and they catch up with them while they're encamped at the sea. The same two verbs. Now, boys and girls, it's not just those two verbs. Actually, in that one sentence, or two sentences, which is that one sentence, Pasuk Vav. Pasuk Vav in Dvarim 19 contains 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, no less than 5 connections to the story of the splitting of the sea, of which we've seen 2. The words, 10-year dope, the Hisigo. Take a look at Pasuk Vav a little bit more carefully and see if you can find any more connection to the story of Pharaoh and his conflict with Israel. Let's read it one more time. Because his heart is very inflamed. What does an inflamed heart remind you of? Go ahead. Paro's heart was very inflamed because God made it inflamed. So you have a mention of a heart that's very passionate in both stories, a heart of passion in both stories, running after in both stories, catching up after in both stories, and there's more. What about these words? Because the way will be too far, the way too far. To think about the scene at the sea, what does that remind you of with the Egyptians being able to catch up with the Jews because the way was too far? What does that remind you of? Right at the beginning, what do we hear as the Jews leave Mitzrayim at the beginning of Parshas Bashalah? We hear that Vayehi Bashalah Paro et Ha'am, it happened when Pharaoh sent the Jews, Lo Nacham Elohim Derech Eretz Plishtim, God didn't take them the short route through the Philistine territory, Ki Karovu, which would have been the short route, he took them the long way. And because he took them the long way, what was able to happen? Pharaoh was able to catch up with them. And Pharaoh was able to pin them down at the sea. That's 4 connections. Yerdot, Hisigo, Yecham Levavo, Kiyir Behadera. And the 5th connection? Kilo Sanehu Lo Mitzmol Shilshon. Because he didn't hate him Mitzmol Shilshon, yesterday or the day before. I came up with this, I have to tell you, in a restaurant in Israel. Do you know which restaurant in Israel? It was Tzmol Shilshon. We were sitting in Tzmol Shilshon, and I figured I would try a little quiz while our food was waiting to come. So I asked the people around the table, Tzmol Shilshon, where in the Torah have you heard those words before? Well, one case of Tzmol Shilshon was this case in Dvarim 19. But it turns out that Tzmol Shilshon is a very unusual phraseology that appears 2 other times in the Torah and only 2 other times in the Torah. So anyone know where one of those other times is? It's in the Exodus. Where in the Exodus do we get? By the way, the other time that Tzmol Shilshon appears, anyone know the other time? It's in the story of Laban and Yaakov, interestingly enough. By the way, Yerdo, Yasi, that language is not just in Dvarim 19 and in the Exodus. You know, there's one other time in the Torah, and only one other time known it is, Laban and Yaakov. And what does the Haggadah tell you about Laban and Yaakov? Oh, yeah, that was just like Paro, right? The only difference is Paro goes all the stars. Laban goes all the stars. There's something about Laban and Paro, which are very similar. We've got an Aleph Beta video about it. You can watch that. But I don't want to go there now. But Tzmol Shilshon, Tzmol Shilshon, Laban and Paro, Tzmol Shilshon, Tzvarim, Tzmol Shilshon, Exodus. Where do I have Tzmol Shilshon of the Exodus? Anyone know? 3 codes for correct answer. It's a very tough one. It's actually earlier. It's way early in the story. Anyone know where the Tzmol Shilshon is early in the story?
Burning bush.
Not the burning bush. It's the straw. Very good, Dave. It's the straw. It's the very first time Moshe interacts with Paro. The very first time Moshe interacts with Paro is when he comes to give God's ultimatum, let us go for 3 days. And Paro's like, I'm not letting you go for 3 days. Not only am I not letting you go for 3 days, I have to tell you that I've got a lot of slaves here, and Hain Rabi Mata Amaretz, and I can't just have them go off on a 3-day vacation. What's going to be with my GNP? Right? So if you have time to think about a 3-day vacation, it means that I wasn't working you hard enough. I'm going to double your workload. And when he doubled the workload, he uses those words, these words. Pasuk Zayin and Parakei of Shlok. Lo tosipu matek lam kevin la'am. Do not give them straw anymore. Lilbon ha'obeinim. Kitzmol shilshon. Do not give them straw the way you gave it yesterday and the day before. Hein yalku v'kosha shulam kevin. They're going to go and go find their own straws. But at Matkanot ha'obeinim asher ha'imosim, the same quota of bricks that they're doing today, that they had, Tmol Shilshon, yesterday and the day before, Tasmu land, they should have today too, Lo Tigru Vimenu. You shouldn't take any less from them to your team because they're lazy. Alkin Himsaw, Kimberly more Nalkandus, Malacha. That's why they want to go and sacrifice to God, because they're lazy. So the words Tmol Shilshon were used before also. Now, parenthetically, and this is important, what is really the context of that first Tmol Shilshon? If you think about the words Tmol Shilshon, they're actually strange words. What if you would translate them in English, how would you translate Tmol Shilshon? Yesterday and the day before. But notice in the Hebrew, it's not yesterday and the day before. It's yesterday and Shilshon. What does Shilshon really mean?
3 days
before. So you say to yourself, one second, yesterday and the day before isn't really 3 days before, it's 2 days before, right? Now, you could make it 3 days before, but how would you have to count things for it to be 3 days before? Well, today has to be day one. Yesterday has to be day two. And the day before that has to be day three. It's like a counterintuitive way to do it, but you could make it turn out that the day before yesterday was 3 days ago if you choose to count it that way. But why would the Torah be so interested in using that language of Tmol Shilshon to sort of squeeze the day before yesterday into being 3 days ago? You know why? Because did this discussion between Pharaoh and Moses have anything to do with 3 days? It did. What did it have to do with 3 days? That was Moshe's request. Moshe's request was for 3 days off. And so you think it's a coincidence that Pharaoh comes and starts talking to him about 3 days, right? But the difference is that Moshe was talking about what kind of 3 days? 3 days when? In the future. And what is Paro talking about? 3 days in the past. And this gets you to the cruel, sarcastic part of Paro. You know what Paro's answer to Moshe was? You want a 3-day vacation? I'll give you a 3-day vacation in the past, not in the future. You see, if you have time to be thinking about a 3-day vacation, it means that I, master, was not doing my job well, because what's my job? To keep you working at maximum capacity. If you have time to think about George Washington's birthday and having a 3-day holiday, it means that I've been lax in making you work hard enough. So I'll give you 3 days off. I'm going to double your work from now on. And when you look on life 3 days ago, you'll realize that's when you had your vacation. I'll give you your vacation in the past, not in the future. That was Paro, right? A certain sort of wicked, ironic tit for tat. Okay. 5 references to Yetziat Mitzrayim in the space of a single sentence in Dvarim 19. Now, I ask you one more time, if you had to take the bet, maybe it starts looking like a better bet. It doesn't seem quite, you know, if it was just one thing, Az Yavdil Moshe, but all this stuff, it just doesn't seem coincidental. It seems like, I don't know why, but there's something about what's happening in this law of Dvarim 19, having to do with this inadvertent murder and having to do with this Goel Adam, that is playing off this story of Paro's struggle with Israel and the culmination at the sea. But the question is what? And what does it mean? And how do we understand this connection between the story and the law? For this, I want to suggest that there's a little game that we can play that will be especially useful. And this is a methodology point. If you ever find something like this yourself, if you're ever traipsing through Chumash, listening to, you know, the laning, and something strikes you, and something else strikes you, and something else strikes you, and you say, like, I'll be darned, but it sure sounds like this law or this story is playing off of this other story. Now, that's not just one thing, it's two things, it's three things, it's four things, it's five things, but you don't know what to do with it. And you don't want to ask ChatGPT, it's Shabbos. You can't do that. So you got to figure this out all by yourself. So how are you going to try to understand what the meaning of this thing could possibly be? There's a game that you can play that will help you. But the game is not for the faint of heart. So if you feel a little queasy, a little nervous, or you want to make sure you have a good night's sleep tonight, right, then this might be the time that you might want to leave, because this game really can set your head spinning. It's a game that I like to call Cast of Characters. And the way Cast of Characters work is you take the two stories, or the two laws, side by side, and almost like a playbill in a play, you say, who's the cast of characters in story one? And then you say, who's the cast of characters in law number two? And then you say, how do these match up? Given the text that I see in front of me, how does the Torah want me to match up the cast of characters? Who in story A is corresponding to who in story B? Now, the reason why I say this is not for the faint of heart is because in my experience playing this game, this is where the Torah really plays with your mind. Invariably, there's always a twist in the cast of characters. It's never what you would expect. The trick in playing cast of characters is not to give in to your preconceived notion. Don't just come up with who you think the characters should correspond to. You have to go back to the language of the text. Say, based on the language of the text, what does the Torah think the character over here corresponds to over there? So let's play cast of characters. Let's start by putting out our cast of characters. Let's start with Devarim 19, our story of the inadvertent murder. Let's just lay out who our characters are. Give me your character in Devarim 19.
Goel Adam.
The Goel Adam, the family of entrance, character number one. Give me another character in our story. I've got the murderer. I have the inadvertent murderer in the story of the Goel Adam. Who else do I have? I have the victim, right? So I've got three people. I have the family avenger, the murderer, and the victim. Okay, do I have anything else? Let's expand cast of characters. Good. Let's expand cast of characters a little bit. I've got a whole character called the Ir Miklat, right? I've got an Ir Miklat. So an Ir Miklat, that would be part of my setting. Let's include it in cast of characters. So I've got four characters now. Do I have anybody else in cast of characters? It's actually, interestingly enough, if you continue in Devarim 19, which we didn't read, but just fair warning, there's a second section in Devarim 19 that talks about the murderer with malice aforethought that does not have the right to go into the Ir Miklat. Devarim 19 goes on to tell you that if the murderer with malice aforethought tries to seek refuge into an Ir Miklat, there's a mitzvah upon the Ziknei Ha'ir, the elders of that city, to actually take hold of them, the shalchu v'lachu, to go and send forth their hand and take hold of them, literally, physically pull them out of the city and give them into the hands of the Goel Adam, that they might die in the hands of the Goel Adam, because innocent blood needs to be preserved and gets to take seriously the innocent blood that was shed by the murderer with malice aforethought. So we might also include, if we go that far, we might include the Ziknei Ha'ir, who are the Ziknei Ha'ir. But there's also another character that Kobe mentioned in the story, which is God. What role is God playing in the story? An interesting question. What role is God playing in the story of the inadvertent murder? Remember that little mushroom that the text gives? Let's say there was a guy chopping wood in the forest. Chop, chop, chop.
And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the axe handle flies off. And it goes 30 yards away and just happens to hit that guy over there. Right? That's right. Who's God? God, we might surmise, is the behind-the-scenes manipulator, which is exactly, by the way, how Chazal understands. You know the famous Chazal? How does this story work? God brings together two people, somebody who deserves to go to God, somebody who deserves to shy, right, and puts them together. This is God working behind the scenes. But remember, that's the way you and I can view this from the side, looking at this theologically. It's not the way the Goel Adam thinks. If you're the Goel Adam, you don't think about the behind the scenes manipulator. Who do you think? Who's responsible for this? Right? The murder. That's why I'm Goel Adam. I just say, look, I don't know from behind the scenes manipulator. All I know is that you were chopping the wood over here, and it was your axe that killed my brother. Right? But that's your view of it. Okay, great. So that's our cast of characters over here in this story. Now, let's start matching them up. We had a Goel Adam, a family avenger, in Dvarim 19. In our story of the splitting of the sea, who is playing Goel Adam? Paro is playing Goel Adam. How do you know that Paro is playing Goel Adam? How do you know from the text that Paro is playing Goel Adam? Because he's the one who is chasing, right? The chaser, the one who chases and catches up, is the Goel Adam. Who chases and catches up in Shmos? That is Paro, the Goel Adam. Okay, so we know, this is where it gets a little mind-bending, we know that there is a murderer in Dvarim 19. Who is the murderer in Dvarim 19? The people of Israel are the murderers. How do you know? They are the people who get caught up to, right? Who are the people who get caught up to? That is the inadvertent murderer who's running away. Who is playing inadvertent murder? Israel is playing inadvertent murder. Now, at this point, I see you getting very uncomfortable in your seats. Thinking to yourself, one second, I thought this was going to be a nice, inspiring year. I thought you'd see us in Mitzrayim, and I come out of here with all this guilt, thinking that I'm a murderer or something, and my people are murderers. That is a very good question. The Torah is playing with you, with cast of characters. So the question is, how is it that we can possibly understand this? But for some reason, the text is suggesting that Paro is a Goel Adam, and we, Israel, are inadvertent murderers. How could that possibly be? The answer is Makas Bechodes. The Torah in Dvarim 19, two dots, one dot, is using its second dot and telling you something about Yetziat Mitzrayim that you wouldn't have otherwise known. Telling you something about Paro's motivation in Yetziat Mitzrayim that you wouldn't have otherwise known. Because a half an hour ago, if somebody gave you an entrance survey walking through the door and asked, what was Paro's motivation in running after the people of the Jews? What would you have said? He wants his escaped slaves back. But if he wants his escaped slaves back, then the Jews, when they said to Moshe, fearful as they saw the Egyptians approach, there were enough graves that you took us to die in the desert, what should Moshe have responded to them? Relax, guys. Pharaoh doesn't want to kill you. There's no economics in killing you. He just wants to escape slaves back. The worst thing he's going to do is just bring you back to Egypt. You'll just have to work there. Why are you so worried? Answer is, the Jews knew something about Pharaoh's motivation that we just now discovered, which is, it's not just about getting your escape slaves back. What really is lying behind Paro, who's running after us? Vengeance. The inflamed heart of that. He just lost millions of Bechoros, and he's out for blood. Because who does he see? He doesn't see an unseen force. All he sees is us. The Goel Adam never sees the unseen force.
which leads us to another cast of characters. Who's the unseen force? God. We Jews, we say, who, us? We can't do anything, right? This was all God. It was the unseen force, right? But Paro doesn't know from unseen forces, especially Paro, by the way, doesn't know from unseen forces. Why? Because one of the great subtexts of the story of Egypt, right? This is something I talk about in my book, The Exodus, we almost passed over, is this conflict which Paro has, which is, will he recognize the reality of the master of Egypt? Will he recognize the reality of God? Over and over, early on in the Exodus, God says, I'm going to establish my God. Doesn't ever work. You look carefully, right around plague 7, Paro gets it. For the first time, Paro speaks in moral terms and sees himself as in the wrong. Hashem HaTzadik, V'ami V'ami HaRashayim V'yosei. God is the righteous one. Me and my people are the wicked ones. I'm really sorry. I'll let them go. And it looks like the Exodus should be over at that, but it's not, because Paro changes his mind. But this time, when he changes his mind, it's a little bit different than all the previous times. Because the previous time, he never comes to that conscious recognition of God. It was always kind of staying away and avoiding that recognition. But now that he's had that full-throated acknowledgement, there is a God in the universe. He is the master of morality. He's the creator of the world. He's in the right. I'm in the wrong. Now, when he hardens his heart, he's like taking that truth and throwing it away and willfully blinding himself to that. And when that happens, God says, in essence, at the beginning of Parsha, both of there's a new game plan. It's no longer the Adum Mitzrayim Kiyamayasha. No longer about Egypt coming to understand it. It's about you coming to understand this. It's you going to tell your children and your children's children, Etasher Hitalalku, to describe the way I played with Egypt and the way I used them like pawns. And from this moment on, Pharaoh is like a pawn. So Pharaoh, at this point, after plague 7, is actually no longer cognizant of the master of the universe. He's willfully blinded himself to this. So if Paro is willfully blinded himself to this, he looks around and says, okay, who killed my Bechorim? Put yourself in Paro's shoes. If you aren't willing to recognize God, who killed your Bechorim? The Jews, led by Moshe. Now, what would confirm that for you? And would say, that guy Moshe, boy, is he evil. He said it was going to happen. When did he say it was going to happen? All the way at the beginning. So Paro, oh, I get it. This really was malice aforethought. At the very beginning, I remember when he asked me for that darn 3-day vacation. What did he say? He said that if you don't let my firstborn child go of God, but all through your firstborn. I wonder what could have been his motivation. So ruthless, killing millions of innocent Egyptian Bechorim. Why would he have done that? And then something dawns on him. Something that Devarim 19 clues you into. Mol Shel Shem. Bar 19, description of the inadvertent murder. The Hulo Sunday involved in Paul Kilchum. Do you know what an inadvertent murder is? Someone who doesn't really hate the victim yesterday and the day before. But it just so happened that who used those words, Paul Kilchum? How did he use them? In a hateful, sarcastic, cynical way. He made our lives hell with them. He doubled our workload with those words and snarkily said, sure, I'll give you your vacation. I'll give you your vacation in the past, not the future. And if Paro was looking for a motivation of why the Jews should hate him so much that they would be willing to do anything in revival, in Paro's mind, it might just come down to that snarky thing that he said, Kol Shel Shem. The Jews are not those who could be considered those who didn't hate the victim to Mol Shel Shem. They did. They don't deserve any kind of refuge. They deserve for me to kill them, for me to completely destroy them. And this is Paro's view of the story. In fact, though,
Paro's wrong. We weren't the ones behind Makat B'chor. God was the one behind Makat B'chor. And God decides. If you're God, you're looking at this. What are you thinking? Oh my gosh, what a terrible misunderstanding. I mean, my poor Jews are being blamed for something I did. What's the least I should do? And Paro's running after them. And there are these inadvertent murderers being accused by the goal of Dom of killing them. What should I do? What's my obligation? I got to give them some sort of refuge. What refuge does God provide? Who now is the Ir Mikvah of the story? It is the Yam Suf itself. But then I say, well, one second, what do you mean it's the Yam Suf itself? How does the Yam Suf become an Ir Mikvah? An ocean, is it the city? How does the ocean become an Ir Mikvah? Well, an ocean, does the ocean become a city? Oh, interestingly, when you split unnaturally the ocean, which is a big water world, what happens? Hamayim lahem choma, miminam umyismolam. What kinds of places have chomot?
Cities.
Welcome to the urbanization of the sea. The sea just became a city. By the way, and you see it in a clever little play on words, an anti-grammatical play on words. It's all, by the way, and it's simple because if you know anything about warfare, if I'm an attacking force and I have people pinned in at the sea, right, and I want to destroy them, what's the first thing I do? I'm coming from, you know, the east over here. And what am I going to do if I want to destroy them? First thing I have to do is I need to, what do I have to do? I must surround them to cut off any escape routes. So if they have the ocean here, I have to surround them on three sides, and then I can close in and destroy them, right? So what does God do by splitting the sea? And now there's a mayim lahem pomami minamim. What did God just prevent? The pincer motion of surrounding. You can't surround anymore because there's walls of water. So you're forced into just coming from the rear, right? Which is what happened. So God actually used the walls as defense, which, if you know anything about military action, urban warfare, you always have a place to hide. The walls do provide refuge. And here, the walls were in our mikvah. They provided refuge for us. You see it, by the way, in the words of Shir HaSayam. You ever think about these words, uberuah hapecha? What's the next word? Uberuah hapecha? Ne'er mumayim. What does ne'er mumayim? Ne'er mu means the water piled up. But it's also a play on words. Because think about ne'er mu. How do you spell it? Ayin, resh, ne'er. Now, if you wanted to say in Hebrew, the water became urbanized, what's an ear? How would you say it? Wouldn't you say Be'er Mumayim, right? As if the waters became cities? I mean, it's a play off of those words. It doesn't mean that, but it's a play off of cities. So Shir HaSayam is playing off of that. It's as if God provided cities for us. But here's the conclusion that I want you to say with that. Cast of Characters has one more twist for us. Cast of Characters always plays with our mind. And here is a great place. You know, it's a great theory. And right around now, you might be willing to say to yourself, you know, if I could do that double or nothing thing on the house, you know, I think maybe I might be willing to take a chance on the house until I tell you one more thing that's going to make you think twice about taking that bet. It turns out that there's one more parallel between the story of Aryan Mikvah and the story of Shir HaSayam. And this last parallel almost completely destroys our whole theory. It does. It just completely destroys everything. Now, just in the interest of honesty, I'm going to tell you what it is. Here's the last parallel. The last parallel is that if you look through the story of Devarim 19 and the inadvertent murder, you'll find that there's a word used for the way that the murderer flees. You know what the word is in Hebrew? Nas. The word is nas. You have it a couple different times
in the story, right? If you look at it carefully. Right? Any rotzeach could flee there. A couple of verses later, again, a couple of verses later, he's always running. The word for running is nuts. Now let me ask you a question. That word nuts, does it ever appear in the story of the climactic battle between Israel and Egypt at the sea? The word nuts. Right? Oh, it does. At the very last moment, right before Egypt is destroyed, Egypt says, "But Yasser has opened Mashavotah." God takes off the wheels off of their chariots. "But Yanageu b'tfigur," and it becomes impossible to move the chariot. At that point, "By Yomer Mitzrayim," Egypt says, "Anusa mitnei Israel," I will run from Israel. "Ki Hashem nilcham lahem," the Mitzrayim, because God is on their side, battling for them against Egypt. And that's the last thing that the Egyptians' army ever said. But the problem is, this really messes with our Catholic character. Because who is the one who is nuts in Dvarim 19? Who's the one who's not? The Rotzeach, the murderer. But who did we say Mitzrayim / Pharaoh was? The Goel Adam. But all of a sudden, they're being described as if they are the murderer. What in the world is going on? The whole theory's falling apart. All right, gentlemen, it's nice having you. What is going on? Do you understand? This is a problem. This is a crisis. What's the meaning of this?
An intentional murderer also.
Exactly. The answer is the role of Mitzrayim just flipped. At the end of the story, it flipped. Something happened. As they say in Hebrew, Nafal ha'asimah, right? Something flips in Paro's mind. Paro goes from being the Goel Adam to being the murderer. The murderer? Why would Paro be the murderer? Who is he the murderer of? He enslaved the Jews, but that's not murder. And how did he murder them?
He
burned them with water. Do you understand? Here is Pharaoh denying the existence of God up until the end when the chariot wheels start coming off, and then it's like, oh my gosh, there's God. And the second he realizes there's God, he starts to run, because the minute he realizes there's God, he realizes something else too. He self-righteously thought that he was the Goel Adam for the Horos, and that he was the self-righteous, vindicated Goel Adam running after the inadvertent murderer of the Jews, but he forgot the beginning of the story. He was the murderer. He's the one who killed all of our babies, throwing them into the sea. And there was a Goel Adam for those babies. The Goel, who is the Goel Adam in the story? Who is he running from now? Anusa mipnei Israel. Why? Ki Hashem nilcham b'hem Mitzrayim. God is real, and he's fighting for the Jews. As if God said, allow me to introduce myself. I am the Goel Adam. The Goel Adam for all of those murdered babies. And Pharaoh and his minions will die in vengeance, the same death that they inflicted upon those babies being drowned in the sea. And in the story ends in Devarim 19, telling you about what happens if a murderer with malice aforethought tries to seek refuge in the city of refuge. Well, what does Paro do? Paro turns around and runs into the walls of water, seeking refuge from them so that he won't be surrounded by God. And then what does God do at that moment? He actually doesn't immediately make the walls come down.
You would think that's what he does, but he does something else first. He issues a command to a person. He doesn't have to. He could do this all by himself, but he tells Moshe, Nete et yad, stretch out your hand over the sea. Then the laws will come down. Now, according to Deuteronomy 19, what's the law when a murderer with malice aforethought tries to illegitimately seek refuge in Aron Miklat? Whose responsibility is it to do something about that? Zikmei Ha'ir. Who is playing Zikmei Ha'ir in our Catholic character? Moshe. Now, why would Moshe do a Zikmei Ha'ir? What's the ear? What's the ear? The ear is the sea. Why would Moshe do the Zikmei Ha'ir? Indeed, the only one who survived. The only baby who survived to become an old man with him. He is the Zikmei of this sea. The Zikmei of this ear. And it falls to him. So God says, stretch out your hand. Just like what the Zikmei is supposed to do. The Shalach Halakha. He's supposed to stretch out his hand and take. You have to take out Paro and pluck him out. And then the waves will come and destroy him. And that is what happens at the end of the story. The waves will come and destroy him. And Moshe is mimicking God. In vengeance, but he's also mimicking someone else in compassion, helping his people survive, helping them survive, the same way someone helped him survive, by stretching out their hand. You remember Chazal about the daughter of Pharaoh. She sends out her maidservant, and Chazal tells you it was her hand. As if she was the first one to send out her hand. And when God tells Moshe to send out his hand to save Israel, what he's saying is, you need to mimic, right? If you're in a war against Pharaoh, your mentor is the daughter of him. You save everyone the way she saved you. And so if we want to commemorate this, well, before that, let's get back to the Akedah. So why do you think the Akedah would have anything to do with the Exodus? Because why would it be necessary to have the Akedah? We understood why it was morally justifiable for God to ask for the Akedah. He wanted to establish that he was the real parent. But why would he do it? Why would he force Avram to go through this play-acting thing like he was this abusive father? That God could come out of the cloud and say, don't touch my child. The answer is, who does God play in our story? Goel Hadash. And who's the only one who can be a Goel Hadash? Family member. God has to establish himself as a real family member. You know why? What was the relationship that the crown of Egypt had to the people of Israel? Going all the way back to the times of Yosef, what kind of relationship did Paro have to Yosef? Paro pulls him out of a pit. He doesn't just pull him out of a pit. He gives him nice clothes. He doesn't just give him nice clothes. He gives him a wife. He gives him a job, right? He takes care of him. He gives him a new name. What kind of person gives you a wife, gives you a job, gives you a name, gives you nice clothes? Right, gives you a car. He gives him a merkevet hamishneh. Who does Paro remind you of? Father. Because Yosef had had a contentious relationship back at home, had left without knowing quite what his father thought of him. Maybe father was in it of the plan to do away with me, but now there's a new father, the Egyptian crown. And he was very loyal to Pharaoh, and his people were loyal too, which set in motion the possibility of slavery, because when the taxes of the work first started to come, we had a loyalty to the Egyptian crown. They were our father, but they became an abusive father. Suddenly, there's an abusive stepfather, and the question becomes, who's your real father? And God has to come out of the clouds and says, you know,
I can be your father too.
The battle between fathers is really what Yetzirah Mitzrayim is about, where God says, who's your primary father? It's almost as if God had to have established with Abram, look, I usually don't get involved in custody now, God says to Abram. But this one time is really important. Are you going to let me into this relationship? Are you going to let me be father? I'm going to have to be father if your people are ever going to get out of the mess that they get themselves in. I need to be the goal of God. I need to be the family inventor because you know why? If I'm only the king and not the father, if God is only king, does he see that's right? Never happen. Think about the rules of the king. Elohim, he's got a bias toward the laws of nature. He put into place the laws of nature. Who said there's going to be signs and wonders just because there happens to be one nation that gets abused? That's not the way it works. Unless I'm your father. The father doesn't care. If you kidnap my kid, I'm coming for my kid. I'll break all the rules. I'll break the rules of physics with miracles. I'll even break the rules of morality. I'll come after all of your Baharos, no matter how many they are, if you hijack my Bahar and kill my child. And God, as father, seeing us as child, the need Bahar and Yisrael, let into that relationship by Abraham, actualizes that in the Yetzirah Mitzrayim. And so therefore, we want to say thanks. When we sing the song at the sea to say thanks, it's not enough just to sing. If God protected us at that moment by giving us our enigma, as it were, what do the laws of the Torah say we need to do to express that thanks? It's not enough just to sing. There's an unfinished harmony for the song of the sea, and it's the law of our enigma. What God is saying is when you build a society, pay it forward. And when you pay it forward and you give those who were unjustly accused, when you give those who are unjustly accused because there's an unseen force, but the Goel Adam doesn't see the unseen force, remember what that was like for you and have compassion for that innocent life that's threatened. And if you really want to say thanks, don't just sing, but establish the kind of just society that expresses that kind of compassion, which you yourself were once the beneficiary for. That's how stories become our laws. I wish you a very good Pesach, and thank you for coming on.
But if you guys want to, if anybody wants to stick around for 5 minutes, you can go now, but in 3 minutes, if you'd like, I will share with you the rumination that I share with ChatGPT 4 about what they had to say. So if you want to play, but thank you very much. Yeah,